This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Pie in the Sky Media. This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. You're listening to episode 80, A Conversation with Jonathan Hirsch. Criminal Mischief Nation, you are in for a treat. We were really excited to chat with Jonathan, who is the podcast host of Dear Franklin Jones. Jonathan does something really worthwhile in this show. He takes us on an extremely personal and emotional journey, while at the same time, he's funny and doesn't take himself too seriously. You see, Jonathan grew up with parents who followed a man named Franklin Jones, and his parents believed that not only was Franklin Jones their spiritual leader, but their God, for 17 years. But to people outside the group, Franklin Jones was a cult leader.
So let's start off with you, with your name and title, like how you would like us to refer to you in the show.
Yeah, my name's Jonathan Hirsch. I'm a documentary audio producer. And I head up Sony Music's podcast creative division.
Awesome. That's so great. We have so many intersecting stories. And that was kind of the catalyst for our conversation today, is just how many stories that you've brought to life that are amazing, including your own story, Dear Franklin Jones, a podcast. When did that drop?
It was in 2018.
Okay, not that long ago.
Yeah, about 5 years ago at this point, or I guess six. It feels like a world away from today, but yeah, it wasn't too long ago.
It feels like something you would do, like coming to terms. Well, why don't you describe it for our audience, because it's really amazing.
But before we get to that, I would love for you to go over how you decided to make it for audio rather than trying to go a more traditional route that would take 20 years to make it into a TV show or a film.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was already producing audio at the time that I decided to make the series. I had way back in 2014, when I first got into audio, I had launched this little podcast in the, which I recorded in the closet of my apartment in Brooklyn, called Arrivals. And it was basically like these non-narrated documentary stories. And back in the day, you know, there weren't too many other shows that were doing that. So I was able to kind of use that as a springboard to get into the audio industry, and get into podcasting in particular, which, you know, long story short, landed me in journalism and eventually at NPR, where I was working at the Story Lab, producing pilots and also working on a number of different shows at the same time. And it was around that, in that moment, that Dan Taberski's series, Missing Richard Simmons, came out. For those who aren't familiar or don't remember, it was a hit podcast that essentially sort of traced the disappearance of this, you know, fitness pop culture figure, Richard
beloved
Simmons.
Beloved American institution. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, and the host looked into that story with humor and intelligence and just a really compelling narrative. And when I heard that story, I thought to myself, oh, wow, I could actually tell a story in this format that wasn't, you know, a super weighty true crime story like Serial that had just come out. And maybe this is the way that I tell my story. You know, there's this saying that like people, everybody has their story. And, you know, some people have more than one and some people think they have more than one. And in reality, those stories are off track and not interesting. But, you know, I think in my case, there it's undoubtedly so that I had the one story and I was trying to find ways to tell it over the course of a decade. I was in a band in my 20s. I was also writing. Both of those were places where I tried to tell the story of Franklin Jones, my parents' guru. But it wasn't until I heard that podcast and I was working in narrative audio and in journalism that it became really clear to me that this might be a path forward. I was working on projects at Stitcher at the time, which was the publisher of Missing Richard Simmons. And I spoke with the executive producer there. Her name's Jenny Radelet. And I said, I have a story for you. So we sat down in a conference room and I brought recordings of Franklin Jones and I played them on my phone. And I basically just told her my life story. And we walked out of that room with the agreement that we needed to find a way to tell this story. So I'm indebted to her for believing in it and championing it and seeing how it was relevant to other stories that they were trying to tell at the time at Stitcher. Stitcher, for your listeners who may not be aware, is now a part of the SiriusXM network. It was acquired recently, but it's had a lot of lives over the years. But at the time, it was one of the dominant publishers of narrative storytelling. So it was a tremendous opportunity, I felt, to tell my story and have a platform to do it. So that's kind of how I got there. Mm-hmm. And for those who haven't heard it, Dear Franklin Jones is a 7-part series that documents my childhood and my life being raised in a cult group in Northern California. It features my parents. It features members of the group. It features recordings and conversations that Franklin Jones, the guru, had with his followers. And I like to think about it as both a cult story, which have become so much more prevalent since that series came out, but also a memoir. Mm. And that's where I felt like this medium could do my story justice. I could try to make sense of what had happened to me in this context, but also to do it in a way that felt like it was a really deep story. It was something I could creatively sink my teeth into.
Did you achieve that goal? Were you able to figure out and decipher like kind of what happened to you? Like, were you successful in that?
Yeah, good. I think so. I think it opened up other doors along the way, but it was a necessary moment for me. And it's an abiding one. And I talk about this quite a bit that, you know, now I look 6 years into the future, and a lot of my work is with journalists and storytellers and writers and producers who are developing their own material, oftentimes of a deeply personal nature. And I'm able to draw upon what that felt like for me at the time that I made Dear Franklin Jones. And I was also fortunate to have an incredible team that helped me make it. The editor of that show, Annie Aviles, was my first editor as a reporter. Ashley Cleek was the producer on it. Was a dear friend. The three of us together felt like we were a unit conquering that material, and they could challenge me in places where I might have had blind spots. And they could give me the support that I needed to tell a story that was so vulnerable. And so I find myself frequently in this position as I'm producing other series that I can use that vulnerability as a strength to help other people tell their stories. And that's a really meaningful thing that came out of that process that I didn't expect.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to you, I was so, you were so vulnerable and I so appreciated it. And I know how hard, I mean, reading some of your poems to Franklin Jones.
Oh God.
And listening to your rock band, I mean, it was so funny. Like, I loved your humor in it because it's like, as an audience, you need that humor. And it was so, when you tell these stories, you know, I mean, Brandon and I can, I'm speaking for Brandon, but we can relate to that in the sense that he ended up doing a podcast on The Devil Within because he experienced this. I'll let him explain that. But, and I ended up doing The Shadow Girls because of these stories that are so powerful and influential in our lives. And like, how do we tell them? How do we, you know, you do it through poems, you do it through storytelling, like when you're young and you're kind of clunky and you don't really know, but you gotta get it out. Right.
Right.
And so I was rooting for you the entire time. And I just felt like,
thank you.
It was really hard to hear on the one hand, you interviewing your parents because it was just very layered. You know, that had been so tough for you because they're still believing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a generation of people that, and I hope this comes across in the work, but it's a generation of spiritual seekers that my parents were, you know, a part of, that saw their life as this kind of linear journey towards spiritual growth. And when you inherit that journey, you may not come away with the same attitude towards its outcomes. And I guess what I mean by that is not everything is progress. Sometimes we actually make mistakes and we spend long periods of time going down rabbit holes that don't wind up benefiting our lives. Yeah. And that was a very difficult thing for my parents to hear. That their son might believe that long stretches of their lives may have been better used or better utilized doing something else.
Yeah.
Did you make any enemies or lose any friends?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I lost all of my friends from childhood by doing that show. All of the kids that I grew up with in the group. No, I don't speak to any of them anymore.
Because they're all still believers.
Yeah. Or even the ones that have left or somehow peripherally are involved or, you know, are not affiliated, but still quietly believe that there's something there.
And they think that you're a traitor or that you're, you know.
I was trying to think about the word that one of them called me the other day. I think it was dissident. I was a dissident.
Sure.
Like I was some kind of like political activist or something that had like tried to, you know, defect from the establishment or something.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's just a really profound, profound statement that we spend long stretches of our lives doing things that don't benefit us. Okay. And how
I
difficult,
believe that.
Of course. So, I mean, I don't think it's up for debate. What I think the problem would be is convincing people of the veracity of that statement, especially the people that need to hear it the most would probably be the least likely to climb on board with that because of what it would mean for the wasted time in their lives.
For them.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. That's to me, that's the key there is that the wasted time for them.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, all I wanted was to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
That I looked at the landscape of my childhood and I thought, you know, all these bridges that we burned, all these barren stretches of plain that we walked down, maybe I don't want that. And can you hear me, mom, dad, when I tell you I don't want that? And when you look at that same landscape and you say, no, no, it's full of flowers. It's beautiful. It's rosy.
It's truth and beauty, everything.
See it like suffering is beauty. And I'm going to trudge my way through this Byzantine maze of promises that this guru is making about if you really do the work, you're going to get somewhere. You know, that I think is what they saw that landscape to be. So if I confront them with a very different reality, that is my reality, that is clear as day real as a reality to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tough thing to accept. And I think that was, I feel like you hit the nail on the head, Brandon. I think that was the biggest lesson for me of doing this story. It wasn't that I came somehow to peace with the traumatic parts of my upbringing. It was that, like, I saw my parents and what they wanted for what it was. And I think I may have also in that moment come to grips with the fact that it wasn't about me. And that is not necessarily a recipe for closeness either with the people who are in the group or with your family. So I don't really think we ever got past that.
Was there any hesitation before going into this? Cause you had to know that you were bringing a fucking wrecking ball into this whole thing.
I mean, yeah, I think there's a reason it took me so long to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the versions of telling my story that I had attempted were so clearly not all in when I look back at it. You know, it's like a song, like notebooks full of thoughts, you know, a half-written memoir.
It was so sharing those for anybody who's been on this kind of a process. Yeah. It's really clunky and it's really vulnerable and really emotional. And yet it's so relatable. Like even if you haven't been in a cult, like you can relate to, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak, of whatever it is that we're doing, you know, that you find out that was kind of 2 years of my life. I wish I wouldn't have done that. But in this case, it was basically your entire life. And your parents, you know, I feel like even though they were still holding on to it, they were open to giving you this, not final gift, but an important one for you to ultimately heal from this experience. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think in a way you're right. Their participation, regrettably or not, did give me the clarity that I needed to move forward. And I think anyone who's been through a traumatic situation, whether it's escaping from a cult, whether it's experiencing violence, emotional or physical or otherwise, I think you come away from traumatic experiences with a desire for clarity. At least I did. I didn't care what the bottom looked like. I just needed my feet on the floor, you know? Mm-hmm. And that clarity allowed me to move ahead right when I needed to. You know, I'm like starting a business. I'm about to have a kid. I've now just, you know, we just had our second child, but at the time it just felt like my whole life was barreling towards something that this unclosed chapter in my life was not going to help me, was not going to do me any favors if I didn't at least bring it to the surface. And the only way that I knew how, with storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any parents equal? I'm sorry, Carolyn, were your parents equally of equal belief? Like they were both like, hell yeah, this guy is the way. We're raising our kid in this, and there was never any kind of little bit of sunlight between them, or no, it was all in.
I mean, I think they were both in. She may not appreciate me saying this, but I'm going to say it because it's true, because it's part of my story. But I think my mom was all in on her husband.
Oh,
that's fair. So, you know, I think he was very committed and obsessed with finding spiritual liberation.
What does that even mean? Like, what does that look like? I mean, was he expecting to wake up one day and go, ah, liberated spiritually. Here we go. And what would that feel like? Like, what does it look like? How do you know?
I mean, I think he was reading a lot of the spiritual books and philosophies that promised this kind of this enlightenment, you know. I think about, for example, you know, in Zen Buddhism, are you guys familiar with like koans, like this, you know, these like little stories that kind of like impart this truth. Yeah. It's very much a part of like the Zen Buddhist tradition. And, you know, one of those stories that my dad absolutely loved, and I'm probably going to butcher the context here. So anybody who actually knows the story, forgive me in advance for trying to recall it from memory, but it's essentially the story of this like monk or like an abbot, you know, like somebody who's like running a monastery, and this, ambitious young disciple, this person who's like trying to learn the lessons, but he's very young, and he sees the master of the monastery walking around, and whenever somebody comes to speak with him, he would just hold up one finger. I don't know, the camera would just hold up one finger, you know, and then as I guess it was sort of to like express that all things are one, you know, that there's only one consciousness, or, you know, enlightenment is understanding the universe as being one mind, you know, however,
it was his tradition you're that in. Was his contribution.
That was what the master would say to all the people in the monastery. And this young boy saw this and started copying it, you know, and at first people thought it was cute. He's like running around and like holding up one finger, or like, oh, little so-and-so is, you know, mimicking the master. And then at one point he tries to do it to this master. Mm. And he takes his finger and chops it off. And then he lifts up the finger sort of in this robotic way that the kid does. This is a dark story, but he lifts up the hand and sees that there's no finger there and is enlightened in that instant. That's the story. Now, that says a lot about my dad, right? Like, you know, this Hungarian refugee who experienced tremendous violence, first at the hands of the Nazi occupation,
then the Russian occupation,
Budapest, and then later the communist occupation. Yeah. He had to flee, you know, to the border in the middle of the night in between guard shifts to not be caught. He had to leave his family behind. He has a quarter inch scar across the length of his face from when shrapnel from bombs from Nazi air raids hit him on the head as a 4-year-old. Like, this is not somebody who experienced a polite, guarded, safe version of the world. And here he is as a 45-year-old meeting this spiritual younger woman, my mom, after a failed marriage, decidedly committed at that point in his life to finding like meaning and truth and something that he could hold on to in the spiritual realm. And I'm sure he read stories like that and was like, yeah, it takes a brutal kind of suffering to get to a place where you can wake up. Mm-hmm. It justified a worldview that was very specific to my dad. So I think that's what the promise of a person like Franklin Jones held for my dad. Was somebody who would, you know, cut through the politeness, who had this radical vision of reality that would, you know, really get to the heart of things, because he generally felt disappointed with his life, with the efforts that he had made. And, you know, perhaps it's one of the reasons, you know, he wasn't particularly keen on looking at the Franklin Jones experiment as a mistake. It would have been one of many in his life.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I mean, it seems like he, at the end, when I was listening to it, you know, from his perspective, you know, he saw that he wasn't a nice guy, you know, the guru. And then he cut their wings for their business being the acupuncturist. He really saw who he really was and couldn't lie to himself anymore about it. But it's like, it also felt like he got wrapped up in this idea of he wanted to be an alkalite himself of some standing within this network. And I think that when you're a speaker and you really invest so much time and energy and effort, you just can't get, you can't give it up. You know, that becomes a drug in and of itself beyond the guru, you know? So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wanted that. He wanted to be in that.
He wanted that.
He wanted that.
He wanted that. Sure. Well,
you know, it's been not to go too far down the rabbit hole here, but like, you know, and it's also been really sad to see, you know, he has dementia now. And just as an update for people who listen to the show, my wife and I are, you know, really the only people he has left in his life, and we care for him. He lives in a nursing facility down the road from us. And, you know, I think that was a very difficult stretch of years when he started to lose his mental acuity, because it came at such a price for somebody who saw themselves on this noble, high-minded journey towards spiritual enlightenment, to lose grip of your mind. It's a really sad thing.
I mean, it's great that you were able to get the story before that happened, because if you would have waited any longer, I mean, he's a key piece to the story.
He is. You know? He is. In a way, my dad is the reason all of that happened. Like, my mom was into spiritual stuff. Like, you know, she liked Buddhism. She lived in Nepal with her first husband and, you know, was into spirituality and yoga. And certainly they met at a satsang, like a meditation.
Yeah, I think you refer to him as the bridge to the real guru.
Yeah, like, he was their starter guru.
Right, that's what it was, the starter guru. I love that.
Yeah.
You had a taste of it.
And if anyone's interested, I did a documentary about that guy.
Really?
Yes, it's called I Am Rama. It's about him. His name, he went by the name Rama or Frederick Lenz. Mm-hmm. It's part of our, you know, our Sony Music Podcast Network, The Binge. There's a series on there called I Am Rama that I hosted that was basically like, whatever happened to that guy? You know, the guru my parents got involved with before, you know, they met Franklin Jones. And, you know, it turns out there's a fascinating and tragic story there as well.
Well, I love how you're bringing this experience to other storytelling and helping other people, you know, kind of being that bridge to like my fugitive dad. We ended up doing a podcast and we interviewed, we did an episode with Ashley on.
Ashley,
yes. And she had great things to say about you. And it sounds like, you know, that was you really helped her tell this story that she had been, didn't even know about.
Yeah.
And was really traumatized by, obviously.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Cause I think what I went through in, you know, processing what happened to me through Dear Franklin Jones, became kind of this roadmap, at least for me, in working with Ashley to tell her story while also, you know, kind of revealing for the first time to the world the story behind Ted Conrad, Tom Randall, the subject of my fugitive dad, the dad in my fugitive dad.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I first met Ashley, and I can't remember if she talked about this on the show, but from my vantage point, you know, I was looking into the story of Ted Conrad and I was absolutely fascinated. This idea that this guy, this 20-year-old kid working in a vault in a bank in Cleveland would watch the Thomas Crown Affair and become obsessed with the notion that he could rob a bank just because he could, like Steve McQueen. And maybe he was out somewhere in the, you know, in Monaco driving fast cars and drinking expensive wine now, right? There was this myth about him that built up. This young guy becomes obsessed with Steve McQueen, steals the equivalent of $1.8 million, walks out the front door of a bank and is never seen again. And then there's this U.S. Marshal team, father-son team over generations that seek with all the power and the resource of their office to answers to what happened that day when Ted Conrad stole all that money. And they wait half a century before they can find an answer, only to discover that the man who did it, his identity was totally different than what it had been before. He was living under a pseudonym, much to the surprise of his wife and children. Mm. And so when I heard that story, those sort of bullet points, I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. Like the father-son piece of it with the U.S. Marshals, the family that didn't know, this guy who creates this, you know, perfect con and gets away with it. I wanted to know everything about it. And so I had reached out to the Marshals and I had interviewed people in the Cleveland area, and sort of the Cleveland piece of the story had been pretty well established, at least in the reporting I was able to do, but nobody from the family would talk. It was impossible to get people from the family to talk. You know, I even went out to Boston and I met these guys who like worked with Ted Conrad, who became Tom Randall at like the car dealership, you know, and they were telling all these stories, but it was just so clear. I remember having these almost this feeling of like disassociation, having dinner with them, because I was like, I don't think these people actually know this guy. Right. No offense, but they didn't, many of them didn't really know who Tom was. And the people who were at that table who did know, they weren't about to share details with some reporter from California who was like interested in telling the story. And so it took quite a bit of poking and prodding and phone calls until I found Ashley, his daughter, on LinkedIn, and wrote her a message. And eventually she responded, and I was just about ready to give up the story. And this to me is what makes the whole process so, I feel so good about it and so edifying, was that I was fully prepared to drop this story. I'd already gone to, you know, I'd already gone to Cleveland. I'd already gone to Boston. I had done a bunch of reporting, but to me, I thought, if I cannot get inside the life of Tom Randall, this is not my story to tell. Hmm. And I think that sense of certainty about that piece of it came from my own experience with Dear Franklin Jones, because I recognized that this was a family story. And at the heart of it was a man who spent half a century with his wife and children in his community living a lie. Mm-hmm. And if I could not get to the depth of that story, why was I even doing this?
Yeah.
And then I met Ashley and sort of confessed all those things to her, you know, when we finally were able to get on the line. And I think it was that immediate connection and understanding that we both wanted the same thing, which was the real story, not just of Ted Conrad, yeah, but of Tom Randall. And then we could go about telling that story together. But I don't think if I hadn't been on the journey I've been on as a documentarian, from all the way back to Dear Franklin Jones to my journey with that story, I do not think my fugitive dad happens. I just don't. I think another great version of Ted's story happens, of Ashley's story happens, but not this story, not the one that we were fortunate enough to be able to tell.
I think that that's the story that everybody wants to know, because when we were doing our bonus episode, Brandon and I were like, how can you live a life so boring after having romancing this huge thing? And like, that would be hell on earth. I mean, nothing against his family, and he's a great family man and all that, but it's like to not be able to be a pro golfer, like what he really wanted to do. I mean, just all these things. His story is, how does that happen? So I think that your instincts were obviously absolutely spot on to not do the story unless you could get the family. And I'm glad that, you know, Ashley was able to, you know, you connected with her and
And we've all talked before. I'm sure your audience is aware of the fact that people talk before they go on shows together. So I hope I'm not piercing a veil here. But I will say that, like, we've all had this conversation recently about how the landscape of true crime and documentary is changing in this one very meaningful way, which is, I think audiences want authenticity. Awesome. And they want the inside story on
the truth.
The truth. Yeah. They want more than just the voice from nowhere telling you the details of some juicy true crime story. And I think we have enough history in the genre and in documentary in the sort of streaming era to look at what has come before us and recognize that oftentimes victims, family members, people who are adjacent to a criminal act or a criminal themselves, play parts in these kinds of stories, these big, juicy, true crime stories. And sometimes it's appropriate for them to play parts, but there are times where people come away feeling like the true story was left behind in interest of the most salacious details. Mm-hmm. And if you don't approach the medium with an understanding of what it's like to be a person, an everyday person thrust into that kind of a context where you're like a voice in a big documentary, you can miss the forest through the trees. Mm. And I think there's a very easy way to make My Fugitive Dad as an example, or even Dear Franklin Jones as an example. There's a very easy way to make that story that misses all of that personal story. And I do believe that listeners want that story. And not only do they want that story, not only does it super serve our podcast super fans, it's the right thing to do for the people involved. Yeah. And it empowers them in a way that I hope that I continue to have an opportunity to be part of in the stories that I tell in the future.
Yeah, I completely agree.
What I loved about that whole story about this guy, I lived in Hollywood for a long time, and I lived down the street from a litigator for the Justice Department. Okay, and all he did in LA, it's all bank robberies. That's like all it ever was. Okay. And he consulted on some scripts and stuff every now and then, but he was a really low key, like under the radar guy. And we'd have these barbecues and everything. And I would try and like get shit out of him. Like, well, you know, and one night he goes, what nobody understands is that if you need money, let's say you need like 20 grand for like a legitimate purpose, like a hospital bill or something. Okay. And if you have the balls, you could rob a bank one time and get away with it, and we'll never find you. Because I'm just telling you how it is. We won't find you. The only people that we catch are people who think they're smarter than us and keep doing it over and over and over again and develop a pattern and leave evidence behind. And that's how we catch them. He goes, but if you hit and run, do it one time, don't worry about the vault, like full, like Point Break kind of stuff. Just go to the teller, get the money and get out of there. He goes, we'll never find you. And that's what this guy did. Right. Yeah. He inspired by Thomas Crown Affair, but he worked up the nerve to do it and to walk out with the money. And then he had to live this quiet life for the next 50 years, you know?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. I think that part is so fascinating that in a way, you look at it on the surface and you're like, did he just like stumble into this? This feels like it's either a criminal mastermind or just a impulsive kid who made a rash decision. And, you know, the tempting version of the story is the one that existed for many, many years before we made My Fugitive Dad, which is he saw the fast cars and the opulent lifestyle. And he was like, I want that. And then he did it. And then he got away with it. And then he had to live with the feds, like, you know, over his shoulder every hour of every minute until he finally confessed. Sure. Like that's part of it. Okay.
It's interesting.
Fine. Yeah. I'll take that. But if we had not gone into the story with this other view, we would have missed everything that happened to contribute to Ted deciding to steal the money that day. And that to me is an almost more interesting story, that, you know, he struggled being, you know, part of, you know, his mom remarried and their new family, and her new husband was not somebody that he had a good relationship with. And then, you know, he went to college and stayed with his dad, who was a professor in New England, and his dad had remarried and he wasn't really welcome there. And then he comes back to Cleveland, and it's around that time that he starts to think, well, like, I don't really have a lot of options on what I can do next with my life. And I'm working this job at the bank and the money's right there every day. And God, Steve McQueen pulled it off. Right. So you start to see this story emerge that's much more nuanced and much more complex than what maybe the headlines for years sort of told. And I'm just really glad that we got to get into some of that.
Yeah, and what I loved about it, what I loved about this guy's story and how he stayed hidden for so long, like hiding in plain sight, and how it just, he happened to be a golf pro. Okay, because I don't know, I don't know if you golf, but when you,
I do. I have a great story about this, but yeah.
Okay, so do I. And so the thing was that when I was being taught like a golf swing, my instructor kept saying, make sure it's something that you're comfortable with, because it has to be repeatable over and over and over again, with the fewest things that stick out, because anything that's weird or that's awkward is going to mess it up. It has to be repeatable, same thing every day, not showy, like not anything like that. And that is a microcosm of how he had to live his life for 50 years. Don't stand out, repeatable, do the same thing over and over again, or you'll go to jail. You know, so the golf swing for me, when I was thinking about his story, the golf swing was just this great analogy for how he had to live his life.
Yeah, no, I think that is really cool. And you know, in trying to understand what was going on in his mind, I also think that we had an opportunity through Ashley to tell a version of Ted's story that really, really shows his most aspirational self too. You know, the way I was thinking about it as we were crafting the last episodes, you know, if you found out that your parent, like, let's just say you find out like your dad has a criminal record, he's got like an arrest in Maricopa County, and you're like, Dad, what were you doing in Phoenix? I thought you were living in Los Angeles, but like, I stumbled across this record that you were arrested, like, and spent a night in jail. And, you know, the specific fact of that story 30 years later, when this person's like, you know, married, has a family, and is talking to their child about the time they got arrested, the specific fact might be, oh yeah, I got too drunk at a bar one night, and I just got into a tussle with this guy who said something to me that pissed me off, and I didn't mean to do it, but I punched him in the face, and there was a cop in the bar, and then I got arrested and I spent a night in jail. That's like the blow by blow account of the story. But there may have been a different story. And oftentimes decades later, we look back at our lives and we see that story through the lens of the emotional truth that was there. So that parent might very well say to you, you know, yeah, my mom was really sick, and she just spent all day inside for like months at a time while she was like fighting this illness. And I had just started college, and I was just feeling really alone in the world, and I had lost my job that day. And I walked into that bar and I did something stupid, you know, like that's the same story from like a truth perspective. They're both accurate depictions of what happened. But one tells you a lot about what life teaches us, and the other one tells you just what happened.
Right. One has this human vulnerability that's as its foundation. Right.
And so the, like, you know, the mythological version of Ted's robbery, I think it fits more neatly into like a facts only based assessment of who Ted was, but who Tom saw himself as towards the end of his life. And that period of time deeply informed our ability to understand why he did what he did. Yep. And I'm glad that we were able to advance the narrative in that way, because otherwise the story would just be, it would be one version of the truth that was less true to him. You know?
I think that with these kind of bank robber stories, and there's what we want out of it. Like, it's like the ice cream, you know, you want to think about him living this life, you know, being rich. It's our fantasy to imagine ourselves in his place, because we don't have the guts to go and do that or whatever. Right. And so that's what we want as a story. But what I love about stories like this, just exactly like you, is that what is going on under the surface, the emotional stuff of life, and how you learn and how you grow and how you change. And like, just that he, I mean, I could just sit there and think about how he had to live like that for 50 years with that secret.
Right.
And like, that's like that repeatable golf swing.
Yeah.
And living like that, that would be awful.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be like the worst thing for me. You know, somebody would be like, I love that. I want to live the same golf swing every single day of my life, and I'm just so happy with it. But, but like, you know what I mean? Like, that's where I'd love, and I think we could definitely connect on those types of, you know, it's so much more interesting underneath, but it takes time to get to those stories. And if you wouldn't have gotten to Ashley, you wouldn't have gotten, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's something beautiful about Ted Tom's story too, in the sense that, like, he may have wanted the life that he ended up with.
Yeah.
You know, he might, his life in Cleveland without Ray, his stepdad, and his mom remarrying, and all the stuff that happened in those early years, the difficulties he experienced emotionally, personally at that time. Like, he may have very much wanted the exact life that he got, which is probably why he felt so compelled to not tell anybody.
Right.
For decades.
Maybe not, he loved even his cars kid. And golf and he had a kid and, you know, wife.
Yeah.
And
he had Boston. It. He had, he had a beautiful life. I mean, he could be the criminal mastermind that all the headlines seem to make him out to be up until now, but he might have also just been the scared kid who made a really bad mistake.
Yeah.
And had to live with it. Side note on the golf piece, I wanted to tell this story for a while because I had a chance to.
Oh.
I got into golf at around the time that I started working on this story.
Oh, wow.
In part because it was such a part of, you know, Tom Randall, Ted Conrad's life. And he's this talented scratch golfer and missed opportunity to have been a pro golfer and all that. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I played basketball growing up. And so I always kind of knew in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, there's a lot of similarities here that I think I will enjoy the sport, but I never got into it. And then I started and I was like, this is an amazing, amazing sport. And I totally fell in love with it. Like anyone who gets the bug. And I was like, I'm not good at all. And that's not really the point. I think I'm not in a rush to be good either, because it's the kind of sport you can play for your whole life. Mm-hmm. But I was going with a buddy to a par three course. This was like, you know, when we were in the middle of reporting.
Which par three?
It's the Arroyo Seco course over in like Highland Park area in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's just like it's like just every hole is like 120 yards.
Yep.
You know, and know straight. It's just not particularly challenging for people other than me. But we were at one of the holes and it was just like that. It was like 120 yards straight ahead, like at a little bit of an incline. So like the hole was like kind of up on a little hill for us non-golf people. And I swing my first hit, I swing the club and the ball kind of like gets some good distance, like 120 yards. It's like kind of right where the hole is, but off to the left, off the hill, about 40 yards away from the hole. Typical Jonathan Hirsch golf swing. And I walk over there and I'm telling my friend as we're walking to the next shot about my fugitive dad. And I was like, this story, this guy's like a golfer. I think you're going to really like it. And he's got this whole thing that everybody I talk to says that was his kind of rule when you're swinging a golf club, you know, in golf, like you have the club and you wind up into a swing and then you swing through. And so it's called the wind up and then the swing. Right. And so he had this way of teaching what you're supposed to do when you're swinging a golf club. And he said, you have to say to yourself, flex and flow, right? Like you wind up, you cock back with the club and then you swing through. It's flex and flow. And it was like a thing. Anyone who knew Tom Randall would be like, oh yeah, flex and flow. That's Tom. And my buddy was like, you should try it. And I was like, okay, all right. So I'm 40 yards out up on a hill, not a particularly talented golfer, never tried this before. I take a swing and I think to myself as I'm like taking the swing, flex and flow, right? I like wind up and then I swing through and I hit the ball. And I am not kidding, this was the most magical moment of my entire non-illustrious golf career, but it must have had a lot of spin on it because the ball pops up into the air really high. And my buddy told me, he was like, I thought the shot was going to like sail past the pin onto the other side of the green. Pops up into the air and it's spinning around. And I felt like it was happening in slow motion. I kid you not. It's spinning high up in the air, starts to come down and drops straight into the bucket.
Flex and flow, baby.
Lost my mind. That's everybody who was playing with another twosome. Just everybody. It's like, I cannot believe
it. And it hadn't happened to you before or since?
Never again. And never, and did not happen before. It was Tom. I'm telling you. Tom was like, all right, I'm going to give you one golf lesson for free.
Well, that's good. I'm going to try that. The course right
flex
near
and
me
flow.
Just shut down. Yeah, flex and flow. I just, I used to live two blocks away from a par three and it just closed down. So I'm bummed.
Oh,
about
too
that.
Bad. Yeah. I wish I lived two blocks away from a par three.
It became a problem for a while. Yeah, yeah. It became a problem, but I did.
You know, so Jonathan, what was the fallout from the podcast? Like how did it do? What was the reaction?
From my fugitive dad?
Yeah.
I mean, on a press level, the story just exploded. It went viral. It was the number one story on Apple over the weekend before it launched. It was the number one story on CNN.com, the number one story on FoxNews.com. These were like all different stories that they ran. We had articles in the Washington Post. Ashley appeared in the season finale of the new season of America's Most Wanted, the one that just finished where John Walsh came back. So it got a tremendous amount of press. And I do think it's because Ted Conrad has this kind of DB Cooper curiosity for people, like, oh yeah, the guy who robbed the banks, kind of like that guy who like, you know, stole a bunch of money from the feds and jumped out of a plane and was never seen again. Like he has that kind of mythology to him.
It's the deathbed confession. There's something so romantic about that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's so dramatic when you kind of tell the beats of it. Yep. So it had a lot of positive feedback. And, you know, certainly there is a ton of interest from film and television about the story. And, you know, more on that in the future, but definitely it has commercially been very, very well received. You know, Dear Franklin Jones was a number one show for weeks that summer. Mm-hmm. But commercially, My Fugitive Dad is by far the most successful project that I've ever done. So that's been really nice, you know, to see audiences find it. Thank you. I'm really happy with how it did. In terms of how people received it, I think it was widely positively received, at least by the people who were close to Tom, because we really worked hard. And with Ashley as our guide, told Tom's story too.
Mm-hmm. Which is what she wanted when she came on our show. She said, you know, I wanted the truth of who he really was and not just the bank robber, you know?
Yeah.
Which is really important.
Yeah. And Ashley is an incredible person that I'm just really grateful to call a friend now. I mean, we talk all the time. And I think
has she found peace with everything?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I haven't checked in with her in recent days about how she feels about her dad and how all of this came together. But I do think that she got as close to peace as you can get in that situation. And, you know, enough that she's continuing to trudge ahead with telling her dad's story. You know, this is not going to be the last time you hear from Ashley Randall about Randall.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. I had some other questions, but I think we're
wrapping
up.
Are we out of time? Okay. this is great. It's been so fun to talk to y'all, and you're such great listeners. And,
one quick thing at the end. Where do you see the future of true crime podcasting going in the next year, 5 years, 10 years?
Wow. I do think we're going to continue to see these more personal stories. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of that HBO series. It's called The Truth About Jim. Mm-hmm. Sierra Barter is a family member of this guy, who she suspects is potentially was a killer or even a serial killer. And her family is brought into the story in this really meaningful way. It's a really beautiful way. I think stories like that are really interesting to me. Stories like Dear Franklin Jones and My Fugitive Dad. And I would put The Truth About Jim in that kind of category. Stories where we're centering the experience of people who are deeply connected to the material. I also think stories like The Love Has Won documentary. I don't know if y'all have seen that. It's about this cult in Colorado. But unlike a lot of cult stories, and for your listeners, like I couldn't recommend this series more. But like a lot of cult story, unlike a lot of cult stories, it's really told from the point of view of people who were part of it, mm-hmm. and delicately positions the narrative in a way that doesn't make them look like, doesn't judge them for their beliefs, but does tell the story from their perspective. And I think we have for too long kind of missed the mark on how to bring people's experience into the documentary form, particularly in podcasting, because it's just accelerated so fast. There is less, there's less criticism. There's less aesthetic discussion as there are in other mediums, like in film and television, for how documentaries can be made. And I'm cognizant of the fact that I just pointed out two documentary TV series. Sure. But I hope that true crime as a genre and podcasting in particular continues to pick up that point and to tell these stories more. The other thing, and just like shout out to Payne Lindsay and Up and Vanished and that whole franchise and the new, I think it's called Land of the Midnight Sun, that series that just came out. Absolutely riveting storytelling. Real-time storytelling reminds me of series like The Australian did a series a few years ago called Teacher's Pet, that also had this sense that you were like investigating a story in real time and you're just like in it. Serial to an extent, season one had this quality to it, but there's just a lot of breadth and diversity to how we can tell a story in real time that we don't see enough of in true crime podcasting right now. A lot of it's like retelling of stories, and look, I'm guilty of doing it too in some of the projects that I've been a part of, but I would love to see more of that, more personal, more like in the moment, real-time storytelling, because I feel like those qualities are what make podcasting so riveting when you're listening to it. You're just like, you're hearing this person in your ear doing something in real time. There's just like nothing that compares to that. Yep. So maybe that's not where podcasting is going, as it relates to true crime, but that's where I would like for it to go.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Jonathan Hirsch, and I highly recommend his podcast, Dear Franklin Jones. But don't go anywhere, because we have our bonus episode up next, where my co-host, Brandon Morgan, and I discuss the episode. And if you have a minute, it would be awesome if you would go rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. And as always, thanks for listening. From Cloud 10, Criminal Mischief is a pie-in-the-sky production, recorded in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're produced by Brandon Morgan and myself, music by Soundstripe. I'm Carolyn Osorio, your writer and host.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.